which unfortunately he removed. And but one of them was Ugo Touchette, sitting right here. So it was, let me see, you probably remember this. Correct me if I got this right. So this was pretty amazing. I thought it would be good to share it with the rest of the world. So this is one of the chances in the book, maybe I should do it now. So it said, it was clearly, it was a paper on information and control about, you know, quantifying the amount of information required to perform feedback control, which is a bit of work that Ugo and I did a few years ago, which is now becoming quite trendy. In fact, to the extent that famous people are now stealing it and not referencing it, which is always a good sign. So this person was clearly some old-time control theorist, and said, this paper, while not without merit, and though it does, in fact, make a few points of interest, how did it go? It was, do you remember?
The most pedantic.
Yes, that's right. Suffers from being perhaps the most pedantic, most, what was it, the least actual content for actual sentence written. It was amazing. It was let on like this. It was even, well, let me repeat, it was not without merit. But it went on and on and on this thing. So it was great. But I guess we decided we just submitted to another journal, where it was immediately accepted, right, without change.
I heard this paper had an introduction that the referee insisted be rewritten entirely because the existing one was an idiosyncratic extravaganza.
Oh yeah, I remember that. Well, that's true of the way you write. Oh no, sorry. Wasn't I a co-author on that paper? the first paper I actually submitted for publication was a paper on black holes and quantum information, and it was one in 1987 or 88. And I'm quite sure that the referee was T.D. Lee, who, you know, the Nobel laureate, who'd actually written a bunch of stuff about this. And the referee report said, there is no physics in this paper. Full stop. That was it.
Well, I can't really top that introduction.
Now having established my credibility.
All right, so that's enough to say about what we can learn about quantum gravity and quantum computation.
Yeah, so much of you have heard a version of this talk at Cambridge at the workshop on quantum computation, quantum information, and quantum gravity. That little anecdote about my bit of my PhD thesis indicates, I've been interested in this topic for many years, since the early 1980s. Well, I was a graduate student at Cambridge, and I attended a bunch of, you know, Stephen Hawking's seminar on quantum gravity, and a lot of my friends are quantum gravity people, like Euclidean quantum gravity people. But I never actually had the guts, unlike some people in the audience here, to like come out and declare myself interested in quantum gravity until recently. And so I've been working on this this particular approach for the last 5 or 6 years, and it dates to when I actually started first reading papers about loop quantum gravity. And my initial attempt was to try to relate loop quantum gravity to quantum computation. And I actually tried pretty hard on that without much success, I have to say. So I have a whole loop theory of quantum computation, which I'll show you at some other time if you're interested. It's a, you know, loop spin networks are beautiful for constructing theories of quantum computation. So this theory that I'm going to tell you about is, if I think of other, it doesn't appear to be related very much to string theory or things like that, though I might be related to string theory, I'm not sure. It's perhaps most closely related to causal set theories of quantum gravity, a la Raphael Sorkin. But as you'll see, the kinds of causal set-like things that arrive are a bit different from the kinds of contemplating that theory. And basically, this is a, you could tell this a theory that's, it has a slogan, right? Its slogan is a modified version of John Wheeler's slogan, it from bit. The slogan is clearly has to be it from qubit. Right? And the if you look at the methodology that I followed here, I took also this, you know, famous Wheeler quote about matter tells space how to curve and space-time tells matter where to go. And I take the matter there and I simply replace the word matter by quantum information everywhere. Okay, so this is the slavish methodology that I follow in this program. And this may sound kind of silly to do, right? Or kind of a crackpot thing to do, which it may be, and that's why I didn't actually tell anybody I was working on this for 5 or 6 years while I was working on it. But I actually think that there's a really solid justification for doing this, for pursuing this program, which, by the way, I call the computational universe. It's a program of research. It's not, I would say, I mean, I'll try to present to you a theory, but I would say I regard this more as an ongoing program that suggests a way to look at the universe. And that comes from work on quantum computation, which is what I've spent most of the last 10 years or so working on. And quantum computers are, one way to think of a quantum computer in the abstract is a quantum computer is a kind of a universal mechanism or theory of discrete quantum mechanics. Right? It's been known for quite a while, since work with Feynman and work with Leibniz back in the mid-1990s, that any discrete quantum mechanical system, so any system that has finite number amount of quantum information and that operates according to local interactions, can be, its behavior can be reproduced exactly on a quantum computer, including other quantum computers. So quantum computers are universal systems for reproducing the phenomenology of discrete quantum mechanics. Okay? And that's a very well-established fact. Now, for instance, they're great. You can easily do things like simulate a discretized version of a lattice cage theory on a quantum computer. And it's well known how to do that, and it's relatively straightforward. Okay? So, given that quantum computers have this kind of universal feature...
No, that's
interesting. That's kind of part of my next bit of this program, is to... I mean, it's known very well how to do this. In fact, another humiliating moment of my life, not in these referee reports. That happens all the time, right? You know, so one can't be too humiliated by that in referee reports. But I derived this result that you could simulate things like lattice gauge theories on quantum computers. And I went to Jeffrey Goldstone in the physics department, who was very interested in quantum computation. I told him this result, and he said, "Oh, that's great. Tell me how you do it." And I said, "Oh, well, you know, each local interaction is mocked up by a set of quantum logic gates, and you know, each degree of freedom is mocked up by a set of quantum bits, and you just have a little computation to give you the action of a local Hamiltonian." And he said, "That's completely trivial." Right? Which was quite humiliating for me, since I just, you know, written and published it in Nature at the moment. But so Jeffrey Goldstone thought it was trivial. But for the purposes of this talk, that's good. Trivial is good. I actually think that it might be quite interesting to, in fact, that's why I'm making this kind of loop quantum gravity theory, because my understanding of loop quantum gravity is that loop methods in general are great for things like gauge theory. So I actually think it might be not quite as trivial as Jeffrey claimed on the spur of the moment. But it's an interesting thing to try to do. So it hasn't yet been done and to investigate it in full. But the basic method is trivial. Okay. All right. So given this universal feature of quantum computers for discrete quantum mechanics, one can reasonably hope that if at bottom quantum gravity is some kind of local discrete theory, which may or may not be true, but one can reasonably hope that, then it seems that quantum computers ought to be able to reproduce that gravity as well. So what this talk actually is an attempt to derive or give an account of quantum gravity based on quantum computation. Okay? So that's the end of the introduction. If there are any questions at this point, since I haven't told you anything substantial and substantive at all, right, there might not be. Okay. Good. And I'm very happy to have the opportunity to come up here to the Perimeter Institute, where there are actually so many people who've done such a lot of work on quantum gravity, including people whose papers I have read and tried to get a lot from. And my actual purpose in coming here is to give you the opportunity to beat me into a bloody pulp over this stuff. So identify any problems that you see in what's going on. So I want people to just jump in and tell me what's wrong at any point. That's what this was originally supposed to be, a smaller group. So. This here, there's too many layers of desks between you and me, so you should feel free to hop up on them and come at me if you want to. Though I was told this being Canada, that's unlikely. And the United States would have.
You have the hockey stick, I think.
Yeah, there's a hockey stick. Remember that. Remember that when we move this closer over here. Okay. Actually, once I gave a talk at the Santa Fe Institute, and when I stepped down from the podium, I got jumped by someone. We had a fist fight on the floor. We slammed all over the place. We knocked pictures off the wall. We were rolling over, knocking over chairs. So it's not as strange as you might think.
Who won?
Well, actually, it was a fight over an apple. So I had an apple, and I challenged anybody to take the apple away from me. It was actually a talk that John Wheeler made me give on It From Bit, right? He said, "Seth, give a talk about It From Bit." So my it was this apple. And I was describing the various bits in the apple, you know, bits of free energy, bits of the DNA, bits of making smell, etc. And somebody stole the apple in the middle. I said, well, I got it back. And then I challenged anybody to take it. So at the end of the talk, Don Farmer jumped on me to try to grab the apple. And the apple lost. By the end, the apple had been reduced to bits, let's say. One of these in existence after the end of that fight. So nobody won. The apple lost. Okay. All right. So everybody happy with that? Okay, good. So let me then start. That's the introduction. And so let me just start with reviewing quantum computation. Oh, okay. So the other another bunch of stuff that I learned from reading all these papers of quantum gravity, particularly loop quantum gravity, is that many of the problems of quantizing gravity come from trying to quantize too much stuff. Right, and my understanding of the great beauty of loop quantum gravity, for instance, is that it really successfully manages to identify those degrees of quantum of gravity that should be canonically quantized. Am I fair in saying that? That was my impression of it, but maybe I get the exaggerated impression. Okay. Anyway, so don't try to quantize too much, and I'm going to quantize as little as possible. And in fact, some people will be annoyed because I actually will probably not even quantize the gravitational field. The only thing that's going to be quantum mechanical here is information, right? Because all I'm going to do is create a picture of quantum computation. That was what's going to be quantum mechanical. And all the quantum features of gravity, like statistical fluctuations, quantum fluctuations in the metric, will arise out of this quantum fluctuations in the underlying quantum computation. By the way, Denny Turner has said, he told me, when he heard this Berlin's talk before, he said, something is rotten here, and now I'm going to find out exactly what it is. So I can see him, he's sniffing. He's sniffing right now. So, all right. So, what's a quantum computation? Well, a quantum computation is normally expressed in the following way. You have some program state. Well, you have a set of quantum information varying degrees of freedom, which are typically taken to two states, qubits, quantum bits or qubits. But they don't have to be qubits, but let's just assume that they are here. So if you have some initial program state, which is just some state for your initial set of bits, then you apply a unitary transformation corresponding to the computation, which is actually built up of the operation of individual quantum logic gates. And then in the end, you compare it to some answer state, A. So for instance, if P, this program state can be written as some unitary transformation that just takes all your initial bits in some fiducial state, say 0, 0, 0, 0, and creates this state. All right? And similarly for A, here's the answer state. So I can write my entire quantum computation. This is the amplitude for this computation. My amplitude can be written in the form a state to take 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. So all my qubits. I apply quantum logic operations to them one or two at a time. I'll just take them all two at a time. And then after these quantum logic operations have been applied, I check to see what the final state is. Okay? So this is what a theoretical, theorist picture of a quantum computation. And this is normally drawn in the following way. And the quantum computation people tend to, from engineering practice, tend to have time going from left to right. But because this is a talk about gravity, time is always going to go from bottom to top, the way it really does go in the actual world out there. Okay? Sorry, that was an editorial comment. This is my favorite way of drawing times. Okay, so you could say we start off with a bunch of quantum bits. And then they interact one or two at a time via some quantum logic gates, which give you perform unitary transformations on these. And then you have some more transformations. So U1, U2, U3. Okay. And in the end, when all the dust is cleared, you compare them to some final states. Now, you can also have an infinite computation can correspond to an infinite set of these. Okay? To an infinite set of transformations. But the quantum computation will still give you an amplitude. If I chop off the computation at each point, it will give an amplitude for constructing a particular state at that point. So I don't want you to think that just because I'm talking about finite things here that this method can't deal with infinite computations, because it can deal with infinite computations just fine. All right? So this is the kind of thing that a quantum computation looks like. And I could have any set of wiring diagrams here a priori. It doesn't really matter what they are. And in fact, many of them, there are. I should just note in passing that nota bene, there exist universal computations or wiring diagrams that can embed any possible computation. This is this feature of one quantum computation can simulate any other discrete system. So I can make some wiring diagram that will reproduce any desire that has, as a subset, any desire of local dynamics. Okay? This is a kind of a neat feature of quantum computation, which is very useful. It's universality. Okay? It's useful because it may mean, I don't know if it means it or not, but it may mean that it may not matter very much what quantum computation one actually looks at. But it may not mean that as well.
Okay? Why might it not mean that?
I'm sorry?
Why might it not mean that?
Well, because as you'll see, what happens here is that the way that I mock up, for instance, I can suppose I want to mock up, say, one U in one one model of computation with some other stuff, right? So I could actually mock this up, because this is kind of a feature of how universality works. Here's these information coming in, okay, and then say this gets processed in another picture of quantum computation. It looks something like, you know, like pop in a little stick right there, pop out another stick right here. It could look something like this, right? So one operation here is replaced by several over here. Well, one of the main lessons of what I'm going to say in terms of when I actually come to construct space-times based on computations is that computation has consequences, right? So for instance, it might in fact be that the space-time that comes from this thing, even though it looks almost exact, it looks the same in terms of this as processing information, might be different. All right? So one has to be a little careful about that. But in general, that picture, this is a picture that it might also be that it's the same. I don't know the answer to that. All right? But it might, but in general, you know, one should feel free to use this kind of replacement feature of the quantum computation as a universal feature.
This is just a quantum analog of classical
universality. Yeah, it's a quantum analog of classical universality. Exactly. So, yeah, you right. Exactly the same thing in the quantum mechanical context. Okay? So, now what's going to happen here? The idea is, so this is the basic idea. I gave you all the slogans and stuff. Of course, the slogans don't really mean anything. Like, you know, just in the same way that it from bit is just a slogan, it doesn't really mean anything in some sense. I mean, Pache Wheeler, but I like it as a slogan. But unless you actually make something out of it, it doesn't mean something. So, same thing for it from qubit. So, I'm going to try to make this quite explicit how this works. So, each quantum computation, I'll just call it each quantum QC, right? Remind me, this is the paper, by the way, the paper on this is posted on GRQC, General Relativity of Quantum Computation. Strangely, it seems to be the only paper on that archive for some reason. I don't know why, since the whole archive is supposedly about this. So each quantum computation. So you laugh, but actually, I when I first saw this GRQC, of course, I didn't know. It took me a long time to figure out what QC actually was. And it was A, that it was not, it took me a little while to think it was not quantum computation. And it took a little few seconds of thought to figure out that it was probably, I don't know what it was. Quantum So each quantum computation is going to correspond to a space-time, okay? Actually, it will correspond to a family of space-times. So a family of space-times. And the structure, the geometric structure of these space-times will be derived from the contents of the computation, whose geometries from the underlying computation. So that's the program. Okay? And I'll actually try to be as explicit as you like about this program. today. And by the way, I make no claims about this being the unique or only way to derive a family of spacetimes that correspond to a quantum computation. I just wanted to show that it could be done in one way, and I just tried to do it the way that seemed most natural to me. But of course, what seems most natural to one person is often seems unnatural to another person. And because I'm not a quantum gravity person, well, like many of the things I do are certain to seem unnatural, right? And you're free to change them around to like suggest other ways. Yes?
What's the role of T?
Okay, so T here is not actually time now. But you know that, so note, a quantum computation, this is the key point, okay? And this is what I took, this, by the way, this is what I learned when I was at Cambridge and when I was a graduate student in the 80s. Trying to derive theories of quantum computation from quantum bits, which is what I was working on. It's not really T. The point is that the quantum computation has a causal structure. And we'll actually see it has a set of related causal structures. More accurately, a set of related causal structures. And as I learned from Hawking, and this is, you know, this is well known fact from general relativity, once you determine the causal structure of a spacetime, then you determine almost everything about the spacetime. Indeed, you determine everything about the spacetime with a conformal factor, a local notion of distance. And this is what is exploited very beautifully, I should say, in the literature on causal sets, right? So you can think, indeed, of this quantum computation as being a special type of causal set. It's like a dressed causal set. It's a causal set which is given by this, you know, this graph, right? This directed graph here. This is like a directed graph, right? So certain things come before this or after this, because you could reverse the whole thing in time if you wanted. Okay. But it's dressed in the sense that the lines contain internal degrees of freedom, qubits in our case. And the vertices contain logical transformations. Okay? So that's what makes it, so it really is a lot like causal sets. And I'm actually trying to make it as close to causal sets as possible, because since it's actually not, as all you people who really use quantum gravity here know, quantum gravity is darn hard, right? And so I'm going to shamelessly borrow steel of many features, things that people have derived before me, so I don't have to do stuff myself. Because I've already found it difficult enough to try to do this, okay? So I'm gonna actually borrow lots of stuff from causal sets for this.
So what you have is a partially ordered set dressed with, I guess you have a two-dimensional Hilbert space on each edge.
Yeah, and a unitary transformation. Right, exactly. And didn't you wrote a paper about dressing causal sets with unitary transformations? You've been dressing them for a while. Yeah, so I actually, right, exactly. That's right. And we're not going to take the clothes off these. Well, no, I actually am about to take the clothes off these to some degree. Yeah.
But when you say there that the quantum computation has a causal structure, what you're saying is that it's a partially ordered set. Now, whether that corresponds to the causal structure of a space-time or a manifold is a different story.
Absolutely, and that's what I'm. So I'm going to go quite explicitly into how you get a space-time manifold, or actually, I'm going to say a family of space-time manifolds from this, because there is not just, as I'll point out right now, there is not just one causal structure associated with this right here, this n logic gate structure. There are actually 2 to the n related causal structures. A set of 2 to the n related causal structures, and let me tell you what they are. The number of logic gates. There are n logic gates. Or there may be more, actually. It could be 3 to the n or 4 to the n. Let me explain what these are. Okay. So to do that, let me actually look at what these u's are. I'm going to write this in a suggestive form. This corresponds to a transformation e to the minus I theta times a, where a is hermitian, right? So a is like an energy operator, but it's not yet an energy operator because theta is not at the dimensions of time. So I have not yet disentangled energy from time here, okay? And here's an example, and I'll use this now exclusively, even though it's not the most general case. If a is equal to some projection operator p, right? So p is a projection operator, p squared is equal to p. Okay? This simplifies things, but it's not easy, not difficult to make things more general. Okay. Then, for instance, P could be the projector on a triplet subspace, right? In which case, this would be each of these would be a slot operator, because e to the minus projector on the I theta triplet, e to the minus I theta, eg P is a projector on a triplet. And then e to the minus I theta P is a swap, a continuous swap. It continuously swaps these qubits back and forth, right? And swap is actually, by the way, swap is actually known to be universal on computation universal on a subset of Hilbert space. So this actually would do. If you want to think of it as being swap, you can. And I spent a lot of time thinking about the swap because, of course, swap is a nice operator in the causal sets. So now look. So here there are two eigenvalues essentially. Two eigenvalues. It looks like there's only one, but of course there are two eigenvalues. So the one corresponding to the eigenvalue 1 is just p, and then the one corresponding to the eigenvalue 0 is just 1, the identity minus p. Okay. So this u actually is, I have two eigenspaces for this u, one in which there's an energy associated with the interaction between these qubits, and one in which there's no energy associated with the interaction. Okay? And so what I'm going to do here is I'm going to decompose u in the following fashion. And this, by the way, I'm doing this slightly differently from the way I did this at Cambridge in December, because it struck me that this was a much easier and perhaps more intuitive way to do this. So u is equal to p0, okay, and then I have plus e to the minus I theta p1. So this corresponds, if you like, to scattering. Here these qubits have an energy of interaction, they scatter off of each other, they acquire a phase, and I'll call this an event. A scattering event. Now here, there is no scattering, right? The qubits do not interact with each other if they're in the zero eigenspace. And I'll call this a non-event, right? Nothing happened. Okay? There was no energy. So you see that the zero eigenspace in this picture, as in many places in physics, is important. It's special. It's because it corresponds to nothing happening to these things. Yeah. If they were in Japan, they would yell out mono modo. Because in Japan, everybody keeps their phone on the buzzing mode, which is called mono modo. If your phone rings in a crowded place like this, you have to immediately commit harakiri, which I won't enforce in this case. Okay? So I'll call these events, they'll look like this. Okay, this is a vector. It's going to be a vertex in my causal structure, and it's a vertex in which an angle theta gets rotated. And we can think, if you like, of the action is equal to minus h bar theta. It's proportional to theta, I'm going to choose to give it a minus sign. Okay? And in this non-event, what I actually have to do is I have to remove this vertex from this causal structure right here. Because since they didn't scatter, nothing happened. Okay? This is not an event. So I should no longer say that they're actually bouncing off of each other in any way. And the action is indeed zero. Okay? So I'm actually going to, so this is what I mean when I say that this computation actually gives me a superposition of 2^n different causal structures. In each place, if I have a zero eigenvalue, then I have to excise this vertex and just connect these going through. And no longer do these qubits actually meet at this point, because there's no way to tell that they could meet, right? We're deriving the geometry from what happens to information.
Does it matter how you connect them? Like that? I mean, you could just connect them like that.
Yeah, you could just connect them like that, yeah.
Does that?
Well, it'll give you different structures, but what you're doing is you're just choosing an identification of which input gets identified with which output.
Right.
So I just chose to draw it like that because it's easier. But you could, if you choose to identify this input is going to that output in case they don't scatter. You have to keep track of it, of course, which one is. But it, no, it doesn't matter what you draw. You have to, it's a choice of convention. And I know that in spin network theory, then you use the opposite convention, that this is the identity. But remember, there's another reason why I didn't do that, which is that, remember, this is not actually, this is the identity, but only the identity for the zero eigenspace. So it's not the same as just stuff going through unchanged. Yeah?
So I have kind of flip side of the question, which is, if you multiply u by e to the I theta,
yeah.
The eigenvalues, well, they don't switch, but the zero eigenvalue is now a triplet.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so in fact, so this is so one thing that is clear about when I do this is that there are actually lots of other ways you could do it. And what we'll find is, you know, there are many different ways. What we'll find repeatedly in this is that there are lots of things that look like different spacetimes, but that are not necessarily different in terms of their information processing content. Okay? So yeah, so you could have decomposed it in a different way.
Right, but looking ahead, they also, it again, gives you a different geometry.
Right, and actually, what, so where you get that, for instance, I can actually imagine shifting everything down, right, as you say, so that I give the triplet a phase, and it has a negative energy. Right now, I have, you know, I gave the positive, the singlet a positive energy, but I could have given the triplet a phase and given it a negative energy. I'll get what looks like a different space-time from that, but it will be indistinguishable from the perspective of how information is processed. But, you know, that's okay, right? I mean, one of the whole things about general relativity is that there are lots of things that look like different space-times, but they're actually the same. For instance, space-times that are diffeomorphically equivalent. Right?
But isn't the case here, then?
I'm sorry?
Isn't the case here that they're equivalent, diffeomorphically equivalent?
No, they would not be diffeomorphically equivalent. Well, we'll see here that the set, as we'll see in just a second, okay, in about 5 minutes, the set of invariances of this theory includes diffeomorphism invariant as a subset, but is significantly larger than that. And this actually, by the way, is also true, of course, of causal sets, because you can embed a causal set in a space-time in two different ways. You have the same causal set, but the two embeddings are diffeomorphically inequivalent to each other. Maybe we should, let's argue about that in just a second, okay? Because that's an important point. So let me just nail down this last bit right here. Okay. So in other words, if I have something like this, so e to minus I theta 1 p, and let me just decompose this thing right here. E to minus, sorry about the shadow here. E to minus that theta, so I have two logic gates, excuse me. Then this gets decomposed into four terms. There's one term that looks like this, no interaction at all, right? This is the 0, 0 term. There's one term that looks like this. Sorry, I should do it like this, excuse me. One term that looks like this. This is a 0, 1 term, right? And then there's another term that looks like this. This is the 1, 0 term, and then there's another term that looks like this. And this is the 1, 1 term.
So you have some rule that says that you don't slide the edges over?
No, you can slide the edges over, right? So
0, 1 is the same as 1, 0?
No, they're different thetas, right?
Okay.
And then, you know, think of these bits as labeled. These are different bits. So it would look, yeah, it looks the same, but it's not the same in terms of what's happening to the information at all. So another thing to remember here is that because you have these internal degrees of freedom in the system, things that might look indistinguishable from the perspective of general relativity or quantum gravity are in fact distinguishable because different things are happening to the information.
Well, even from the point of view of causal sets, this would be different, right? Because
yeah.
It could be something different in the past or future.
So I say this is not identical to causal sets at all, right? In fact, this is, so basically, when I take a computation, because of these existing additional degrees of freedom, there's other stuff going on in addition to what happens with causal sets. Even though, you know, from this point on, once I pick one of these things, all right, once I pick one of these, so I'll call each one, I'll call this C sub B, this is a bit string, B is equal to 0001111, or more, if I have more of them. I'll call this a computational history. And from the perspective of general relativity, a computational history is a causal set that has a angle associated with each vertex. And my computation is a sum of, is a superposition of 2 to the n different computational histories. And by the way, if I didn't use a projection operator here, but I just use a generic A, then basically it would be a sum of, you know, if there were 3 different eigenvalues, 3 distinct eigenvalues, it would be the sum of 3 to the n different histories, with once again the 0 eigenvalues being picked out. But this makes life easier to do it this way. Yeah.
So in principle, we can, on 2 qubits, we can have up to 4 different eigenvalues.
Right, that's right.
And but in your case, 0 and 1 are just labels of.
Right. So the fact that it's 0, this is binary, comes from the fact that I chose here a particularly simple set to have just 2 distinct eigenspaces. Yeah. So there could be 3, this could be 3 or 4, it could be 3 to the n or 4 to the n. Yeah, exactly. And remember that, you know, one has to be careful about the interpretation right of this. Here, the bits didn't interact, but this means that they're projected onto this subspace, onto the 0 subspace, right? So when I decompose this thing, I have to keep track of how the bits got projected here. But the point is that this amplitude right here now just gets decomposed, in this case, into 2 to the n different amplitudes, one corresponding to each of these histories. Each computational history has a distinct set of vertices, right, that's constructed in this way, and each vertex has an angle associated with it. Yes?
So what's the relationship of this to sum of registers? This is not the sum of registers as such.
So the amplitude is a sum over computational histories. Yeah, I'm picking this word. I think that it's fair to compare this to a sum of registers.
If I give you the in and the out states,
yeah,
you would normally consider all possible causal sets even stick between the two.
Right, I'm not doing that.
These are the ones that can be generated from a given one.
Exactly. So in this case, I'm really, this is, once again, so the other way that this is distinct from, I would say that this, even though causal sets is the most closely related version of quantum gravity to this, this is very different from causal sets, right? In some ways, you'll see things that are similar, but this is very different. So I'm not, in any sense, summing over all possible computations at this point. I just have one computation. The computation gives a sum over different possible sequences of events. So unlike the causal sets, I'm not summing over all possible intermediate causal sets. I thought of doing that, but, you know, I noticed that people ran into trouble with that in causal sets. And I wanted to avoid places where people ran into trouble.
Right, but then what? It's very nice if you can avoid that trouble. But then, what's the status of the mother set?
Well, I don't know. But for instance, one possibility is that because of this universal feature right here, then you can imagine I just have one universal circuit diagram, and this universal circuit diagram will contain a subset of all possible causal sets, right? Then they will have different weightings from the way that they're normally weighted in causal sets. Because I can build kind of a mother diagram, mother computation, which is a universal computation.
So what was the mother?
That was Fotini's term. So the mother computation, so everything stems from the mother here, right? I'm happy to adopt it, I think that's a fine term. Everything stems from the mother computation. This is the Gaia hypothesis of quantum computation, quantum technology. This mother computation, because of this universal feature, you can construct mother computations that are effectively performing every possible computation. And they also have every possible causal set popped in them as well. But they weight them in a different funny fashion.
I don't see that second part. I mean, what we need for universal quantum computation doesn't, I don't see that as anything to do with having all possible causal subsets. I mean, for instance, well, let's see.
I'm more curious about this.
So for instance, you can do universal quantum computation using, you know, one dimensional circuits.
Yeah. I'll talk about that in just a second. But these things I drew are distinctively one dimensional because I drew them on a blackboard.
But if you put that restriction on it, that puts pretty severe limitations on what kind of causal structures you can.
Yeah, that's true. I hear you. Yeah, so I think I would call that an open question. As to what, you know, is there some other computation that gives you, you can certainly, you know, program any wiring diagram you like, any routing of information through from a computation like this. But whether that gives you every causal set in this sense, I'm not sure. Okay? Yeah.
But, sir. I mean, it's true that, so when one has a sum over histories from relation of quantum gravity, part of the reason for the justification is, of course, that you're making that integral analog of what but also you avoid choosing any particular solution or any particular causal set. It would of course simplify your life if you knew which one to choose.
Well, I would actually say that that's not quite true, in the sense that you are implicit whenever you are choosing a weighting over all possible causal sets. Choose them equally, or you say, for instance, we already had a discussion about, right? Is this different from this, right?
Right.
So from a causal set picture, they're not different, right? But from a computational picture, they are different. So I think that one has to be, I agree with that perspective. And let me just say that this, I'm not trying to go on the attack or be defensive. Let me just declare my weakness, right? And so go on. So I don't know what the right mother computation is. And I speculated on and looked at lots of different kinds of things that one could have. And I actually don't know whether you could construct any, you know, something where the weighting that's given by here is the same as the weighting given by some kind of causal set picture. I don't know the answer.
Yeah, but I'm not really asking whether you knew that because you have quantum gravity, you knew that, etc. But I'm trying to set up what you would need to do. So if you do need to know what a big computation is, then in effect you will have to show that GR somehow emerges from that, so diffeomorphism should appear from what is under.
I think it's time for me to actually do that because I wanted to be careful about this because I want to be explicit about what's going on in quantum computation, particularly for people who are more quantum gravity types than quantum computation. Let me emphasize several features about this. This is a very simple structure mathematically. Okay, it's very simple. And all the quantum mechanics that's going to go into this quantum gravity is now present and accounted for. Okay? So the only thing I'm going to do from this point on is to say, how do you go from these computational histories and this picture of this computation to space-times? But the space-times that I derive will basically be one Regi calculus for every single one of these computational histories. Okay? They'll be basically classical-looking things. So all the quantum fluctuations in space-time are already here. Okay? So from this kind of quantum fluctuation of routing, you get fluctuation in the causal structure of space-time. Either they scatter or they don't scatter. Right? So that gives you a fluctuation, quantum fluctuation in the causal structure of space-time. And these thetas, so either action or no action, these give you quantum fluctuations in the action of, if you like, these underlying internal degrees of freedom. And of course, these underlying internal degrees of freedom are the things that you could use in principle to construct matter fields in a gauge theory. So we have quantum fluctuations in the causal structure, given because we have a superposition of two different things, scattering and no scattering, events and non-events. And we have quantum fluctuations in the action, because we have either something gets rotated by a particular angle or it doesn't. Okay? So all the quantum fluctuations that are going to show up in this theory and all the quantum mechanics is here present and accounted for on this set of six boards right here. So anything time we're going to talk about quantum fluctuations, for instance, the metric with the causal structure from henceforth, okay, it will come from these quantum fluctuations here. And I would say, at least from the quantum computing perspective, this is really simple discrete quantum mechanics. And I've just done all the quantum mechanics I'm actually going to do for this whole talk. I'm not going to talk about quantum mechanics unless asked. All the next stuff will be to answer Fortini's question about how the space-time emerged when you start embedding these suckers, sorry, these things, these computational histories in a manifold.
So, what's the logic to say these things, and how you think of this? If this were a quantum computer, you have actual macroscopic gates that you could fiddle. Presumably you don't have that picture here. This is a microscopic.
Yeah, so if you think of these, if you want to have like a nice picture of this kind of particle-like picture of these qubits are like massless fermions. They're zooming around. They're massless, by the way, because they accumulate no action along these wires. So the action along these wires is zero, so the proper time along these wires is zero. So they're like a bunch of massless fermions zipping around, and they interact with these here. You know, they interact with these gates, and at these gates, they either interact or they're in a state where they don't interact.
So what, the ontological picture of these gates just out there in nature, or?
Yeah, you can think of that. That's right.
With use, which is determined by some ground theory.
Oh, sorry, with use.
The use of
yeah. I would actually argue that it's not, may not, for this reason, it may not be so important what you choose to choose. But it may also be important what you choose to choose. I don't know. Right.
I mean, assuming that these systems are sort of located in some three-dimensional.
Let me talk about that. Yeah. Let me do that now. Sorry, go ahead.
I was thinking that what you're describing is sort of like a spin network.
Yeah, this is exactly right. So far, this is purely abstract. It's not embedded, but now let me embed that. But any more questions about the quantum mechanics? Because now what I'm going to do is I'm basically going to embed these in a manifold, and I'm going to embed each of these gates at a point in the manifold, and then I'm going to have the manifold now will have this computation with all these different causal computational histories. And each computational history will give rise to a different metric for the manifold. And it's those fluctuations in the computational history that give rise to fluctuations in the metric.
So do you address the measurement question?
Oh yeah, no, I don't. This is Murray Gell-Mann, whom I was a postdoc with, has a letter he carries around with him everywhere that says, it's from his doctor, and it says, Professor Gell-Mann is not allowed to discuss questions of philosophy. Right. Now, I actually have an MPhil in philosophy of science from Cambridge, so I can't. Maybe I could just say that, I don't know, maybe I strained myself in those years of doing an MPhil in philosophy of quantum mechanics. So, no, everything takes place inside the computation. So, if you want an ontological version, you basically need to see how classical space-time emerges from this. You need something like, say, decoherent histories to show you why certain histories, or groups of histories, don't interfere with each other. And then, depending on your druthers, you can be a many worlds kind of person about decoherent histories and say they all exist, or you can be a non-many worlds type person and say one of them exists, we just get one at random. But I don't think it, so for what I'm doing, that answers a little bit of the ontological picture, but it doesn't really matter. Okay? But there is no outside measurement or anything like that. Okay? All right. Okay, so let's talk about embedding this. And by the way, I agreed to talk for a while. I'm sure this will take five. Anybody who wants to leave at any point from discuss for exhaustion or anything should do so. But I'll carry on as long as people want me to. Or not actively throwing things. Is that an eraser actually?
Is there one on my
phone? Oh, there it is. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, the clock. Okay. So basically at this point, it's all just going to be basically grunt work of the kind that has been done heretofore, luckily for me, by people who do causal sets and stuff like that. Because what I'm going to do is now I embed this in space-time. Also, I can just do this as follows. So we embed. These points, these n points in a space-time, in a manifold. Fortini was very corrected me about this. My language, I often use language shopping for quantum gravity first thing. Okay? Now what does this mean? Well, let me just show it like this. I just put in x, y, and I guess e has got to go up to some other fourth dimension. Okay? And actually, it could be a d-dimensional manifold at the moment, but in a moment we'll just see that four-dimensional manifold, 3 plus 1-dimensional manifold arises in a natural way, or a somewhat natural way. I think it's natural, but the word natural is open for interpretation. So we embed. Now, it's important for what we're going to do. We could use almost any embedding is fine, right? And that's what Einstein told us, right? We shouldn't care about how we embed things. But we do have to be a little careful, as Einstein also told us, because we don't want to make things degenerate in some sense. So we embed in such a way so that the input and output lines, so that, remember, I have these 4 input and output lines. So these are wires. So that the 4 wires at each point are linearly independent. Right? Remember, these are going to correspond to null lines of our metric, and we want them to be linearly independent. That is to say, we're not right here going to consider computations that are actually squashed flat on the board. Though actually, it's interesting to contemplate these computations that are like squashed flat on the board, and one can certainly construct 2-dimensional spacetimes on them. It's a kind of a string theory of this quantum computation. But I'm not going to do that right here. I will mention string theory one more time, and I hope that will be it. Okay.
And therefore, it's natural.
Yeah, so 4 wires at each point are linearly independent. And let me point out that this is true for a set of measure 1 of embeddings, right? And if it turns out that just by accident, the chance of 1 of infinity, then the 0% chance that it actually happens if they're independent, a slight change in the embedding will make them independent. All right, so this is, I think, a reasonable requirement, and it comes straight from Einstein. I should say that in doing this, actually, I had a lot of fun, and my slavish following of the people who did everything, I read all of Einstein's original papers on this, which was really fun, because I actually understood some of that. And also, you know, he speaks about it in quite a wonderful way. So I slavishly follow Einstein and everybody else at all points. Okay, now this implies that, recall, and this is this well-known fact from, you know, it's in Hawking, remember, the well-known fact is that the causal structure of space-time determines the metric of the root conformal factor at each point. And a closely related point is that, so maybe I shouldn't call it recall. So a fact that is easily derivable, but we're just like slavishly going to Hawking and Ellis, for instance, D null lines determine the metric at this vertex, GAB, up to a conformal factor. In D dimensions. It's basically a really simple rewriting of this proof that if I know the whole light cone of each point, then I know the metric of the conformal factor. If I know just D chunks of the light cone at each point, D linearly independent pieces of the light cone at each point, I know the metric of the conformal factor. It's the same proof, basically. With all the stuff thrown in. I won't go through it now. It's only like a 3-line proof. It's basically entirely in Hawking and Ellis. Does anybody here know who first derived this one? History of general relativity? This causal structure deriving? Anyway. Okay. Okay, so henceforth, I can't believe I'm actually writing henceforth on the board. I'm doing it. Take D equals 4. Because, and so why does 4 dimensions arise naturally in this theory? 4 dimensions arise because we're reconstructing the metric from pairwise interactions. It doesn't happen because they're qubits, it's just because they're pairwise interactions between these information and varying degrees of freedom. Okay? So, and I'm not saying, you know, you could do this for higher dimensions, but it works out very naturally in D equals 4. And you can do versions of, you know, with quantum logic gates that have 3 inputs and 3 outputs if you want to do D equals 6. Or if you have things of different dimension, you can have 3 inputs and 2 outputs. also. Right, so you've got d equals 5, or d equals 3. But that seems to be most natural, and certainly the way quantum computation happens, to have d equals 4. And that's what we're going to adopt from this point on. Okay? And that's all the justification I have for this. I don't have any further justification for this. It's not like some kind of dimensional reduction takes things down from 3 dimensions to some Kaluza-Klein theory in 4 dimensions.
So for this part, it's not relevant which of those lines are coming in and which ones are
out. No. And that's actually very useful. In fact, I won't talk about this today much, but in fact, if you want to give a quantum mechanical picture of black hole evaporation and what happens at the horizon of a black hole, you know, remember that for one of the big problems of quantum mechanics for black holes is that to an outside observer who uses a Schwarzschild metric, the space and time get interchanged as you go in the hole. So for someone using crustfall coordinates following a black hole, they have a notion of what the temporal direction is. But for someone who's using Schwarzschild solution outside, they think that time is now a space-like direction, and space is now a time-like direction. So actually, it's very fun. It's possible, and it's very fun to play with models where you can have time going this way as well as that way. And you can actually make sense of that. But I won't say that, but it's pretty wacky. I won't say anything about that here. All right, so at the moment, just let's consider time going this way. Oh, yeah, it doesn't matter which split is going forward or backwards. That doesn't matter. So there's no temporal direction here. Sorry? Okay. Okay, so we've gotten the embedding. And now let me just say, the next part is going to be somewhat technical, but it's just technical in the Reggie calculus sense. So technical, it's not that bad as Reggie calculus goes. And at least I don't think it's that bad as far as Reggie calculus goes. And it actually took me quite a long time working on this clandestinely, like several years, to figure this all out. But that was more because I didn't know much about Reggie calculus coming into it. Okay. And the thing that made me persevere is that the point here, the primary point about this, is that we're going to derive the metric by what happens inside the computation. Okay? Now, what happens in the computation is independent of how it gets embedded in space-time. So this picture is automatically covariant.
Hold on. What happens inside the computation have to do with deriving the metric?
So, we're going to do that. I'll show you what happens. So remember, what happens, the computation has a lot to say about the metric, right? It determines its null lines, right? So in fact, it's determined the null lines, 4 null lines at each point. It actually, once we've embedded it, the metric is already determined. 9/10 of the metric is determined, right? 9 out of 10 parameters in the metric is determined. We only have to figure out an assignment of the conformal factor at this point. And that's going to, you know, that will be a little somewhat technical. It won't be that bad. But I mean, the point is, the reason that once and everything is going to be fine, so I know that everything's going to be fine right now, because this is generally coordinate invariant, right? I apply the geomorphism, okay? It's still the same computation. So what's going on inside the computation doesn't care about how it's embedded in space-time. And that, as Einstein was very eloquent about, is why is the reason for general coordinate invariance. Okay, and we also know from a variety of beautiful and powerful theorems that once I restrict the order of the terms of the action, that Einstein's equations are the only equations that can arise out of a generally covariant theory. All right? Okay, and let me make one more note to talk about something that was brought up before, which is that I can, of course, embed this computation in space-time in two different ways, and those two different ways are not diffeomorphically related, right? Because, for instance, I don't care when I embed it, I can move wires through each other. These wires don't, you can think of them as localized, but they're not actually very well localized in space. Actually, from the quantum mechanical perspective, this is good, right? Because when I send a particle through like a two-slit apparatus, you know, the particle gets from here to there, but it's not clear which way it went. In particular, the topology of these paths, you know, I can have two diffeomorphically non-related paths, set of paths, that represent the particle getting from here to there. Sorry, doesn't sound very clear, sorry.
But the embedding anyway is only for the gates.
I'm sorry?
The embedding is only for the gates.
It's only for the gates, yeah.
Not for the wires at all.
But the wires get, you know, if I can move the gates over here, If I move, take this gate and move it over here, a wire may go through a point where it's degenerate with another wire and then pass through it, and I'll, then I get to a non-diffeomorphically related.
But you're defining the metric at the point.
Yeah.
You're not defining the metric.
Yeah, that's right. So I don't really care about this that much. But I just want to say, point out, this is true of causal sets, right? If you invite a causal set, I embed it in a manifold, then I can embed it in a non-diffeomorphic way. And I thought I read that one. I think I got that from one of your papers. I thought I did. Anyway, I don't remember correctly. So the important thing is that one should think of this as if, so again, the set of invariances of this series is larger than just the set of diffeomorphism invariants. But diffeomorphism invariants, definitely diffeomorphism invariant. It's just got more than that, which is OK. Okay, so less would have been better.
Can we go back to why D44 when you have these four wires?
Yeah, so my only justification for this, which I actually think is a pretty good, I mean, if you look at justifications for why they're four dimensions, you read lots of these things, right? And they're very different depending on what theory you're looking at. But here, the fact that it's four dimensions comes from the fact that we're reconstructing space-time from pairwise interaction between quantum degrees of freedom. So pairwise interaction between quantum degrees of freedom means you have, say, qubits coming in and qubits going out. So you have four wires, two ingoing wires and two outgoing wires at each point. Right. And this allows you to reconstruct the metric up to a conformal factor in four dimensions. In fewer than four dimensions, it overdetermines the metric, and in more than four dimensions, it underdetermines the metric. So that's the reason. I'm not saying this is like the most compelling reason in the world, I'm just saying that it comes naturally here. And so I'm going to use it.
Yeah. Maybe it doesn't have four components.
I'm sorry?
Okay, I'm not sure about that. Because in 2D, I can have a pairwise interaction.
Right, so in two dimensions, I can do this in two dimensions. If I restricted these angles, so I could actually do this in two dimensions if I have these angles not adding up to 360 degrees. Well, or if I restricted it so that the ingoing ones and the outgoing ones, sorry, if I said these lines are just one line going through, I can do this in two dimensions. And I have looked at that, actually. It's quite fine. So I told you that before that there was a, but maybe you were here for that. There was a two-dimensional version of this, one plus one dimension, a string-like version of this theory, which is wackier. It's wild and wacky. But I'm not going to talk more about that right now.
Because I have a curve, for instance.
I'm sorry?
If I have a curve dimension of space.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you're going to want to have a two.
Yeah, you could do that. Yeah, you can do that there. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But these are supposed to be independent ones, okay? So that is a degenerate case of the case that I'm discussing right here.
You think of each wire as being one number?
Sorry, were you here for the first part of the talk? No. Right, so, no, I didn't think so, since you just walked in. Each wire carries a qubit, or an information varying degree of freedom. And I refer you to my paper on this.
So if you have four wires, you have how many three numbers you can assign to these?
Sorry, each one of these wires is a quantum bit or a quantum information varying degree of freedom in some number of dimensions. Okay? So then you figure out the remaining number, the number. So if these are d-dimensional, then each of these gates is a d-squared, has d-squared parameters associated with it. So you can think of this as representing each of these transitions requires d squared real parameters to describe. Maybe that's a good way of describing of answering your question. Okay.
Different d.
Yeah, different d. Sorry. M is the number of internal degrees of freedom. M equals 2 per qubit. So m squared. Thank you. Sorry.
Sorry.
Yeah. Sure.
Usually, when you think of scattering processes, like you describe it as a conservation law, that you read, but say that the momentum is not energy in
the yeah.
Okay, I don't understand what's the motivation to assume that they are independent.
Oh, it's just because if I embed them, if I embed them in a space-time, they're going to be independent,
so
with probability 1.
Basically, you postulate that the dimension is for you, you don't give you the argument.
No, but no. I'm saying that if I derive this, then I'm not deriving exactly. I said this is the only motivation. Motivation is that I'm deriving space-time from what happens to quantum information, and if I derive space-time from what happens to quantum information, then I can do it naturally in the score. And it's not like if I do it in higher dimensions, it's actually hard to do it because now my metric is very undetermined. Okay? Now, if I go to lower the metric, it's hard to do because the metric is overdetermined. All right?
And so, all conservation laws are assumed.
No, I'm not assuming any conservation laws, because conservation laws are things like momentum and conservation momentum and energy. And remember, so you're asking me what are the equivalent of T A V B is equal to zero, right? That's conservation momentum. It's non-conservation momentum, right? But I haven't told you what this is. So let me go on to that. So, all right, these are all really good questions. I just want to make sure that I get done in time to taste the local beer tonight. Okay. So, now remember, so now what are we going to do? Now let's derive some Reggie calculus. Okay, so now Reggie calculus, numeric bar. So this, I just did this because this seems to be the obvious way to do this. There may very well be other equally good ways of deriving space-time from a bunch of points, to, you know, discrete structure like this embedded in a manifold. But I knew how to do it using Reggie calculus because I worked with Warner Miller at Los Alamos ages ago. So I'm going to do it using Reggie calculus, but there could be many other ways. There'll probably be equivalent, okay? But here we can do this. So now recall, Reggie calculus requires a simplicial lattice. So for instance, in two dimensions, it requires, you know, a triangular lattice in 2D, right? So as you were pointing out, in two dimensions, I can have curvature at these points, all right? Because I have a deficit angle here. In three dimensions, the simplices are tetrahedra. And four dimensions, they're something with five points each connected to the other. So they have, three dimensions, you have three points, three edges. And 3D, just to like, I guess I should draw some pictures like this just so that people, so let me draw like that. Sorry, I'm not doing this very well. Just to rev up your Reggie calculus memories, okay? In three dimensions, you would have four points, six edges, and four faces, all right? And so in five, if I draw this in five dimensions, I need five points here. I'll just connect every one to every other one. Do I do that? Okay, in five dimensions, sorry. You have 5 points, 10 edges, 10 triangular faces, and 5 tetrahedra, right, etc. Okay. So we don't have a simplicial lattice. That's a problem at the moment. This is not a simplicial lattice, right? But we can easily make a simplicial lattice by a standard form, by a standard construction. Construct 4D simplicial lattice by adding edges. So we have too few edges to make a simplicial lattice. To form, there's a standard way of doing this, okay? And many of you probably have heard of it, a sim de Launay lattice. Basically, you, I'll show you how to do this in just a second, at least in the 2D case. And plus, it's associated, this is the simplicial lattice, plus the associated Voronoi lattice. And in case you're not, who here, by the way, has heard of de Launay and Voronoi lattices? Okay, who here has not heard of de Launay and Voronoi lattices? And then some people are in quantum superposition of neither. Many people, I'm sure, have. Okay, right. So I just want to find out to tell the people who haven't heard about it. Okay, so this defines volumes associated with vertices. And it works very simply, actually. So what I do, let me remove some of these lines in the simplicial lattice right here. So now it's non-simplicial. Okay? And there's an easy way to construct this Delaunay lattice. What you do is actually first, the obvious way to do it is first you construct the Voronoi lattice by identifying the set of points that are closer to this point just for the ordinary Euclidean metric, right, than any other point. So I think these are points like this. They actually connect the centroids of these points right here. So this is the boundary, okay, of the set of points that is closer to this point than any other points. And in two and three dimensions, it works exactly the same way. I construct a polygon, right? Or it's a polyhedron. What's the proper word for this? The three-dimensional volume that has the same thing. And the boundary of this forms the Voronoi lattice, okay? And now, to construct the Delaunay lattice, I simply, in places where there wasn't a line before, I simply complete it by going right through the centroids of these lines constructed to these points. And these are the points that are sometimes closest to this, the vertices that are closest to this point right here. And if you think about this for a little bit, you'll see that you end up constructing a simplicial lattice by this technique. And the same goes through in three and four dimensions, okay? First, I construct this Voronoi lattice, and then through each face of the Voronoi lattice, I draw a line. And that connects me to the points of the Delaunay lattice. This, by the way, is a very standard construction. There's whole societies based on this. In fact, there are websites devoted to two cool programs to allow you to draw Delaunay and Voronoi lattices. And this is something that's worked well established. Sorry?
Could you go through once more for the 2D case?
Yeah, so the 2D case, let me do it for this. I'll start without any lines, okay? Okay, I start without any lines. And for a given point, I identify the points that are closer to this point than to any other point. And let me be careful about that. I think it feels like this.
Closest in this kind of background flat metric.
Yeah, this background flat metric, right. Remember, I want to get the, what I want here is to get the kind of the discrete version of the, I haven't described the metric yet, right? So I wouldn't know how to do this with this metric right here, the Lorentzian metric. I'm just taking the ordinary Euclidean metric, I'm making the discretized manifold structure, okay? And then I just connect this to these guys right here. So this one got left out because it was too far away, all right? And then I do the same for these points, and then I'll end up constructing this simplicial lattice. And this is just an ordinary way. If I don't have a simplicial lattice, I've got a whole bunch of points embedded in the manifold. This is the quote natural and quote way to construct a simplicial lattice. It's a very standard construction. Okay?
Does that mean that you're adding lines to your computation?
Yeah, I'm adding lines. And so, yeah, good point. Thank you for pointing that out. So, some of these lines, the initial wattles, may be lines, edges in the Delaunay lattice. Not all of them are, because there weren't enough of them to begin with. Some of them may not be edges in the Delaunay lattice. Like a line that connects a point to something way, way, way far away, that's not an edge in the Delaunay lattice. Okay? So I told you this is going to get, it was going to get regified. So you don't want to commit regicide.
I guess I can see that if you take one of the points, so you have some embedding, and if you take one of your vertices and you fiddle it with it just a little bit, that's going to give you the same lattices.
Right.
So if you fiddle with it a lot,
it will give you different lattices.
Right.
That's right. So this is a problem with regicalculus as well, right? That diffeomorphism invariance in this case, whenever diffeomorphism invariance gets screwed up whenever you do something that has a discontinuity, when you make a move that has a discontinuity in the other underlying structure. And so actually when you move stuff around here, you will get different lattices. So when you move, you want to make sure that you have these non-degenerate lattices as you move from place to place. So the idea here, just in the same way that different non-diffeomorphically equivalent, so embeddings of the computation in spacetime that are not related under diffeomorphism, right, which would not be the same spacetime classically, can correspond to the same, you know, computational spacetime, because there's not enough information in the computation to describe this difference.
These extra lines in this construction
are
just lines that are not related to the computation.
No, they're just lines.
Like each vertex you have already two lines, and some of them now you will have three or more.
Yeah, they could have a lot. Right, absolutely.
Empty blank. Nothing
is on them, nothing's propagating on them. They're just, these are now going to be the Reggie calls them bones. Does he call them bones? No, bones are the hinges that on which things rotate. Right. These are just going to be the struts in this Buckminster Fuller geodesic dome architecture. All right, so all I'm doing right here, in case this, you know, if you're not interested in this, how you construct a Reggie calculus from this, you can just fall asleep at this point. It's okay. Because all I'm doing is justifying the fact that it's okay, that once I've got these constructed, once I've got these embedding, I can construct a Reggie calculus that obeys the Einstein Reggie equations. Okay? So I'm just going through the details of that. So I have to make this look like Reggie calculus. Yeah?
Can you make sure that at least the edges that were there before remain there? I mean, is there an embedding that would preserve these edges?
Not for every computation. But there are certainly computations where every edge that was there before is an edge in the Delaunay lattice. So like, you know, cellular automaton like computations, right? You can set those up so every one of those edges is an edge in the Delaunay lattice. But it doesn't have to be. Right? Okay. All right, so now we haven't fixed omega yet, but let's suppose we do fix omega, and then we're going to see how to fix omega in just a second. But let me just finish the construction of the space time, we need to fix omega, fix the conformal factor at each point. So let's assume we fixed it and then see what kind of space time it is. And once we've fixed it and seen what space time we get, we'll be able to go back and see how to assign the value of omega. All right? So if we fix omega, that's right. Must be the damp or something. Fixing omega at each point, so this is the conformal factor at the Lth vertex. At each vertex L now fixes the whole geometry, the whole Reggie calculus. Whole discrete geometry. Okay? So for instance, if I have an edge length here, and I know what the metric is here, then I average these metrics along this point right here. So this length is fixed. So let me adjust, so this is XA, then the length is XA times 1 half GAB plus G prime AB XB. Okay, so that's the length of this length right here, right? So once I fix these, now I can actually sign, once I fix the conformal factor, because now I know what the metric is at each of these points, now I can assign lengths to all the edges. Okay, so once I assign omega, then I've completely fixed the geometry for a particular computational history.
So then this is not provided, this expression elsewhere, it's x to x a and so on.
Yeah, because once I define it to be this,
yeah.
Right? Once I define it to be this, then it will end up, then this length will stay fixed.
Sorry, what do you mean you're fixing the length? I thought you were supposed to be null.
No, these are the additional, my original ones are null. But these are not the additional struts that I put in. The additional Delaunay struts that I put in are no longer null.
But some of them are the same.
I'm sorry?
Some of them might be the same.
I'm sorry?
Some of them might be the same.
Some of them might be the same, and they're null. Those are null. So those would be null.
Yeah, X was the coordinate or was it the coordinate?
X is a vector. It's the difference in coordinates from that.
Right?
This is XA. XA is equal to YA prime minus YA.
Yeah, okay.
Right.
And then I'm worried about this expression, the GAB plus B prime AB.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if I average in between, I mean, maybe it should be, I should be more careful and say I'm going to take the integral, extrapolate in a linear fashion between here and there. It's not hard to say. I mean, the thing is that we're only actually, since this is very discretized, we're not actually really defining the metric particularly at these intermediate points. We're just defining these edge lengths.
Probably you can just carry along.
No, what you're saying is, I'm worried about this. This is a good point. I'm worried about this, and I'd like to have
it. Look, but surely, I think you can define this for this as a mean distance.
Yeah. Well, I think this may be coherent, actually. Let me check. Yeah. If I average it like this, I think it might be.
You're just adding tensors.
I'm just adding a tensor. Yeah, this is coherent. This is coherent. It's got to be, right? I'm just adding.
No, but you add them at different points. So, if you were adding them, that's at the same point, but you're adding
them. Oh, is this XA is a.
No, inside the bracket, you're evaluating, you have an expression when you're taking a metric at one point of the manifold plus a metric at another.
Okay,
point.
Okay. This is covariant, right?
That's covariant. Yeah.
This is covariant. This is covariant. That's right. My arm is not covariant. Right? Yeah, but let's sit down and talk about this later. This is a really good point. I worry about this too. But I'm not convinced by the argument I just gave. So the argument is this is covariant, and this is a scalar. So
the x depends on your vector. I mean, the x is not a vector at a point. The x is something.
Well, no, it is a vector. So the nice thing is because this is discrete. I mean, this is just a vector at the manifold, right? And it's really a vector of the text, right?
It's one of those lines. It's not a vector.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
In terms of importance, sorry. It's actually two vectors, right? So it's a vector.
Yeah. One is in the tangent. This one is in the tangent space from this point to that point.
Yeah, so
and the other in the tangent space from this point to that point. But in this embedding, they're the same, right? I guess maybe that's the argument.
Yeah, but there's independence on the embedding. On the embedding, right?
Yeah, yeah.
If you roll it down, then you can see it's the y's. You only have the y's. If you choose a different, you will get a different. So there's some
that's a limit.
Yeah,
x is a vector, but now right. You have a point of this.
Right, but you might see, so because it's Regi calculus, I'm allowed to identify the tangent space at this point with a local manifold. Okay. Let's talk about this. I think this is an important point, but let me just go on because I don't think it's that important.
You do place all the curvature in this.
Yeah, and the vertices, all the vertices become the vertices. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's okay, but I'm worried about it as well. So let's sit down afterwards and let's try to thrash this out a little bit. Anyway, so let's assume that we've defined these edge lengths in a suitably covariant way. How about if I just say that? Okay. I think this is a suitably covariant way. Okay. But so now everything. This implies that. So all the curvature is now fixed in particular. So the curvature at each of these vertices is fixed. Once I actually fix the local conformal factors, and so the edge lengths by whatever suitable method I choose to do so to be determined. Okay. And in particular, the curvature. Lives on, if you remember your Regi calculus, it lives on hinges, lives on triangular hinges. In D dimensions, it lives on D minus two dimensional hinges, or bones, as Regi called them, hinges. Okay, so I've got a hinge like this. Actually, right, so I've got a hinge like this. Of course, let me remind you in the two dimensional case how this works. So in the two dimensional case, it lives on zero-dimensional hinges, and hinges are just points, right? And the curvature is just identified as 2 pi minus the deficit angle here, right? Because now these angles don't add up to 2 pi. So in two dimensions, it's just this deficit angle that gives me the curvature, okay? So and in three dimensions, it's a little harder to imagine, but in three dimensions, sorry, let me draw it like this. In three dimensions, what you do is a hinge is a line like this, and you take curvature comes from, it's the product of the length of this line times the deficit angle as you go around this point. So you look at the deficit angle of where these tetrahedra meet up to this line. And in four dimensions, I have a really hard time imagining it. Okay? But
basically, the point is it's always just two dimensions less.
Yeah, so that it's always two dimensions less, yeah. This is very beautiful. I should say that everything I'm doing here comes from a very beautiful, except for once I fix these distances, everything comes from a very beautiful paper by Warner Miller called The Hilbert Action in Regi Calculus. It's on GRQC, it's in classical and quantum gravity, and essentially says one side of the Delaunay lattice, but it's associated Voronoi lattice. How do I get Regi calculus from it? So actually, I can just say, this paper is very nice and it talks about this. Okay, but we have the curvature for a hinge is basically the deficit angle of the hinge times the area of the hinge. Right, that's the curvature for the hinge. And my overall gravitational action is, let me make sure I get all my g's in the right place. So 1 over 8 pi g times the sum over all my hinges, and this is the action of the gravitational field, and it should be compared with 1 over 8 pi g times the integral of the Ricci scalar over space-time in the continuous Einstein case.
Sorry, I missed, what was A again?
A is the area of the hinge. A sub h is equal to area. So the two-dimensional thing. So remember, it's all these things that they end up with the real. If I ignore the g's and stuff, so I de-dimensionalize, or I only keep the dimension of length. Curvature tends to have this will have area of length squared, right? And when I divide by the volume, which would give me the Ricci scalar, I get 1 over length squared, which is the proper dimensions of curvature, and that's true in every dimension. Okay.
All right. How do you know the area is?
So I fixed these edge lengths. It's a triangle.
Well, but it's time to find space.
I'm sorry. Well, locally flat, right? That's the whole point of Ricci calculus. These triangles are locally flat, right? It's like think of the geodesic dome.
So it's all the curvature on these hinges. So that's
okay. Right. So all the curvature in the two-dimensional case, all the curvature lies on these zero-dimensional hinges.
Ah, okay.
Right. And one dimension that lies on three-dimensional lies on one-dimensional hinges. And four dimensions, in some way that I have difficult imagining in my head, lies on these three-dimensional hinges. Some people are better at this than me, than others, and certainly than me. Okay, so now that's my gravitational action. All right, and now recall that the action of my matter fields, I'll call it I sub c for my computational matter. I sub c is just equal to h bar minus h bar times the sum over vertices L, theta sub L. Okay? So I'm now getting in good shape now in terms of deriving some kind of Einstein's equations, because once I fix omega, and remember these guys, all these areas and these deficit angles are actually functions of these conformal factors. But once I fix those conformal factors, then I know what the action is. And I already knew from long ago what the action of my computational stuff is. And this is why these thetas are important, right? Because this is why dressing causal sets is a good thing. It's very useful in this case, because these causal sets got dressed. One of the pieces of clothes they put on, a particularly nice pair of socks, was the local action of these matter fields. It's an angle that gets rotated in Hilbert space. Okay? So this is a geometrical quantity. It only cares about how this diagram got embedded and these local length scales. This is a purely computational quantity. It only cares about what happened to stuff in an individual quantum logic gate. Okay? So it's like energy times time, right? So this is equals, quote, energy times time at that logic gate. Except we don't know yet which is what energy is and what time is, but we know that its product is going to be by h bar times theta sub L. At that logic gate, I'll put an L on there, at that logic gate. So, and this, you can see, this is how we're going to actually, tomorrow, I'm going to talk about how you measure space-time using quantum mechanical things and what fluctuations arise from there. This, of course, is how you measure space-time with clocks, right? If you know what the energy of an atom is, right, in its rest frame, well, luckily we do know that, right, then and you find at how many times, how many angles, you know, in Hilbert space get accumulated as the clock ticks, all right, then you can figure out what the time is. Okay, so, but we don't know what yet is energy and what is time. Okay, but now we do know how to get Einstein Regi equations from here, because here that darn Problems are very nice set of black. This is a very nice set of black force, may I say. And given that I've never given talks using PowerPoint, and the blackboards are getting fewer and fewer in between, I appreciate the good ones all the more. Okay, so what are the Einstein Regi equations? Well, we can get them from saying the total action is the gravitational action, sum of the gravitational action, plus the sum of the computational action, and we have to take the derivative with respect to the metrics at each point, right, and set this equal to zero. So we know what form the Einstein-Regi equations are going to take, right? And so now the question is, if we can assign this, if we can assign this curvature so that they're satisfied. And it should be no surprise if we can't, because remember this whole thing is generally covariant. So it would be very surprising, actually, if we can't satisfy the Einstein-Regi equations.
So what about these that are degrees of freedom? Should we do something with that? You only have G there.
No, I sub C, they're here, right? So IG and IC. Isn't that, that's IC?
Yes, yeah, but we should value with respect to these.
Yeah. So what does it mean to vary this with respect to it? So we know, okay, and Reggie gives us prescription for how we get, right, good question, very good question. And luckily that's exactly what I was about to do, okay? So Reggie told us how to take the variation with respect to the metric of this matrix right here. And let me just write it out before I forget it, okay? So this thing right here is I don't know what the one over four pi's and stuff like that. This thing right here becomes what Reggie pointed out is it's basically I'm missing a factor of g or something like that. The deficit angle doesn't actually change under the variation of the metric to first order. That's the cool part about this. So it's the it's the area that changes the first order. And I don't have the right free factor in front of it. I'll figure it out in a little bit, okay? But this I sub g, Reggie pointed out that actually you get just from looking at the causal variation of the area occurs. And the nice standard formulas for how this works out, okay? So now we have to look at this IC. So what about, how does this, I mean, here it looks as if, you know, this doesn't vary at all, right? Theta doesn't vary at all when I change the metric. But the important thing is that I wrestled with this for a long time, but we have to be careful about this, right? Because if I look at how I get, if I look at how I do this classically, then I see classical is equal to the integral of the Lagrangian dv. Actually, this is the invariant form. I really have a square root of the metric here. And when I take the variation of this, I get terms that come from the variation of the Lagrangian. I get terms that come from the variation of this volume. So I've got to be careful about this because I've got to define what I really mean in terms of this action, in terms of these Voronoi volumes that I had before. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the most general, now remember that, the Einstein prescription, which is not the most general, but Einstein says, okay, the Lagrangian should be a function of the matter fields plus the metric to first order, okay? So I want to make the most general function I can. I want to re-express this action in terms of a function of the matter fields plus the metric. So far, it doesn't know anything about space-time. So I've got to actually insert space-time back in there. So what I'm going to say is that minus h bar, so the action corresponding to a point, minus h bar theta sub l, okay, excuse me, theta sub l, is equal to, now I have to look at the volume corresponding to that point, v sub l, right, so this is the Voronoi volume corresponding to that point, but I have, that's this dv term right here, and now I have to look at something that corresponds to Lagrangian. So the Lagrangian is going to be something that has a, let me sure I get my minus plus and minus signs right here. Well, there's going to be a minus a potential that corresponds to that point. This is like the potential energy of this interaction. And then there's going to be a kinetic energy term, which depends on the metric. that out. But the thing is that my particles are this is the kinetic energy term, right? So this is potential energy, this is kinetic energy. Okay? But my particles are moving along null lines. Right? So I should take this to be equal to zero. So T hat AB, the kinetic energy term is some, as yet unknown, right? We don't know what it is. Some traceless tensor.
So
what I want to do is I want to take the action at a point, right? Now, how do you get Einstein's equation? You have a Lagrangian, okay, and the action is the integral of the Lagrangian over some volume. So what I want to do is I want to define, and now I want to do the same thing in this case, but I want to decompose in terms, I want to decompose my action. So the Lagrangians are space-time things, and volumes are space-time things. Actions are just scalars, right? And in this case, action is just quantum mechanical, not a space-time thing. But I want to see if I actually write this as a space-time thing, right? Then how does it vary when I vary the metric? Yeah?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if I missed something.
Please. Probably not.
In everything that you've done, can I take a view that what you're showing is that if you wanted to do a numerical computation for the evolution of some space-time, a collapsing star or something, which people have been doing on classical computers.
Sure.
You're just showing us one way to discretize this problem and how to put it on a computer in a way that might be particularly convenient if it was a quantum computer. No.
So I agree with everything that you said beforehand, right? But you forgot the quantum part. Okay? All I'm doing now is completely classical. I'm just taking one of these computational histories, one classical-like object with a definite causal structure, a definite angle rotated at each point, and I'm constructing a Regge calculus that corresponds to that. So indeed, what you could do is for a particular one of these histories, right, I can certainly write a computer program that would not, actually, I probably couldn't do this, okay? I bet I could find a good graduate student who could help me do this, okay? So I could write a computer program that would, in fact, just as people do Regge calculus for collapsing stars classically, that tell me what the Regge calculus is for this system, okay? So you're absolutely right about that. But remember that the whole quantum computation is a superposition of 2^n of these different things, which have different geometries. So once, if I can do this for these different geometries, then I will know a lot more than that, right? I'll know how the space-time couples to this computational matter. So I'll have a picture of the back reaction of this classical space-time to the computational, to the quantum matter. So the quantum fluctuations in what the matter does gives rise to quantum fluctuations in what the space-time does.
So I
could actually calculate that in this case. And you can't do that with classical.
So could one say that you're sort of doing classical Regge calculus computation, but in parallel, using quantum parallelism?
So if I wanted to, I could. So if I had a quantum computer, right, sorry, if I wanted to calculate, right, so the quantum computer, you could say, well, the quantum computer in this case is more instantiating a Regge calculus. You could call it calculating it if you want, but.
Okay, instantiating.
So
it's a
quantum. And it's doing many of them in parallel.
Sort of, right, and so. Isn't it still just modeling? It's just computational numerical modeling, except that you have many different evolutions going on here because it's a quantum.
Yeah, right, exactly.
But
so
I don't see that anything is being derived. I mean, I can construct a computer and use it to model collapsing star or something. It doesn't mean that this box I have in the lab is a collapsing star or that I've derived the model of a collapsing star. That just set up a computation. So
right.
What is there anything here that is supposed to, in some sense, a deeper understanding of derivation and gravity?
So let me tell you what you'll get out of this, okay?
Right.
So remember the picture. I have an underlying quantum computation, which I can set up anything that can happen to quantum mechanical stuff as a quantum computation, including something like a lattice gauge series as a standard model. How do I, suppose I want to derive, this is what kind of thing we're doing right now, I want to derive the coupling of, so I've also given an explicit prescription for how the metric couples to that quantum mechanical matter. Okay, so I'm actually, by saying these, each fluctuation in the quantum mechanical matter gives me a fluctuation of the metric, I have given you a prescription for the back reaction of the metric on quantum mechanical matter. So for instance, if I wanted to look how the metric of space-time responds to, you know, quarks and gluons and things like that zipping around, I set up a computation which is quarks and gluons zipping around, which I know how to do, and then I ask, how does the space-time respond to it, right? So I actually, this is prescriptive, and it allows you to calculate stuff which you could not do classically. So I think the answer, I disagree that I'm not doing anything beyond what you're doing classically, because actually, I'm actually setting a prescription that still tells you, for instance, if I have a computation that, I guess a computation, this is the kind of thing we're doing right now, okay, I take some computation that I want to describe the early universe with. I don't know what that is, so we're trying out different ones. Actually, they all look basically the same if you look at what happened. I have fluctuations in the angles rotated at each point. These fluctuations and how things get rooted. These fluctuations translate into primordial fluctuations of curvature that are quantum mechanical in origin. And then I can solve for these space-times in a typical kind of history and see what happens to these fluctuations. Right? So that's the kind of thing that you can do with this. And I find that that's a useful thing to do that you can't do with, actually, it's hard to do that in quantum theories of gravity, right? And it's actually relatively straightforward in this theory.
So you're saying that with quantum computing, quantum computing is better than classical computing if you want to calculate the effect of quantum mechanical matter.
No, that's not my message. My message here is, this is, think of this quantum computation as kind of like a primitive, an underlying thing that's just there, that is responsible for all the stuff we see around us. Okay? But think of the universe as a quantum computation.
Why should I think of that? Look, if, you know, someone has his computer, it's a box in the lab that he uses it to model a collapsing star. Why should I believe that this, you know, little spin is interacting in his box, that is a collapsing star?
No, that's, I'm not asking you to make that ontological leap. No. That's a philosophical question.
I'm sort of confused by that. It's a physical question. I mean, is that box, that box is one thing, a collapsing star is another. I don't see why I should look. If you give me some simple structure that is some, you know, something like a spin network, and you can show me in some surprising way you can derive things that we didn't know about gravity, then I might say, okay, hey, maybe you stumbled on some structure underlying gravity. But here it seems to me you've just done what, you know, if I was just going to model with a quantum computer, do calculations.
No, that's incorrect. Because suppose, first of all, if I had a theory of gravity, right, like spin networks, then that's local and finite, I could use a quantum computer to simulate that. That's certainly true. And it would be better than a classical computer for doing it, because those things are hard to do on classical computers. But that's not what I'm doing here. I'm suggesting that what's going on at bottom is that the universe consists of, you are actually demanding an ontological picture. So as much as I dislike doing that, because I don't think it will help, I'll make a stab at it. The picture here is, you regard this as the underlying construction. The universe consists of quantum bits that interact according to, you know, local transformations, and out of that arises everything that we see. Okay? Now, I actually claim that this is going much further than what you're saying, and does many things that, if I dare say so, even in the company here, that ordinary theories of quantum gravity can't do. I don't want to claim too much of this, but let me just claim what it does give you. It tells you how, first of all, because of this computationally universal nature of these systems, I know already how I can reconstruct something like the standard model in this theory. So I've just given you a prescription for coupling the standard model to quantum gravity. Indeed, I've given you a theory that has not only quantum gravity in it, it has potentially the standard model as well. So I very much hate the words theory of everything. So I call this a potential theory of everything. A PTOE, right, to express my contempt for theories of everything. It's really a research program, right? But it's a research program that has, from the start, the ability to have things like the standard model in it. And it gives you explicit prescriptions for how that the quantum behavior of the standard model couples into gravity, which is something that most theories of quantum gravity don't give you, or at least not yet. Okay. So what? And it also gives you what other descriptions. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to tell them all why. I'll tell you what they are. It gives you explicit prescriptions for things like black hole evaporation. It tells you, gives you a way to calculate things like once you've decided, you know, had an onset at a computation, it allows you to look at primordial curvature fluctuations.
You assume that the total evolution is unitary. I mean, there are people who say that the black hole evaporation, you know, should be purely mixed.
It's unitary in the interior of the computation, but when information goes in and goes away, that is not unitary, right? It goes, starts out, leaves. So actually, in fact, I had for a long time been a kind of guessing that black hole evaporation would be unitary, but in this case, it turns out to be almost unitary, typically, but not exactly unitary. Yeah.
I have a different question.
Yeah.
How do you read off matter content for something
in this theory?
Is it matter content?
Yeah, so the way that, remember the way you do these simulations, right? Suppose I wanted to simulate something very simple, like interacting neutrinos, that this is easily mapped on this, okay? Interacting neutrinos that scatter off each other via the weak force.
Sure.
Right?
So
you read that straightforward in this case.
So and all these boxes that you have is actual data, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
These are the transformation devices, which are purely classical things, they're rotating in a definite way, right?
Sorry, the angles are quantum mechanical, right? So these are quantum mechanical angles that are rotated.
Sure, but they're definite.
They're definite, right. Once you fix the causal history, then they're definite.
So,
but before, right there, they're not definite, right? It either gets zero or theta at each point. There are fluctuations in the angles that it gets rotated at each point. And it, remember, it's a superposition. This thing is a superposition of 2 to the n classical looking things. The quantum computation is a quantum superposition of 2 to the n classical things. And all I'm doing here, and maybe I'll stop trying to do it, so because if people want to talk about more substantive and interesting things, is showing that each of these classical things has a Regi calculus associated with it. So, I mean, I've spent a while just doing dry stuff that actually doesn't have to do with the quantum mechanics. If people want to get back, right, they want to get back to the quantum mechanics. Let me just write this down, then we'll start answering this question. Yeah.
I'm not sure whether any of this is a formal talk, but maybe if you could spend a few minutes wrapping up, and then we could have a Q&A.
Yeah, I've been going on for almost 2 hours, right? So let me just finish this right here. I actually think this part of this is all I'm doing. This is, even though it's the most boring part of this, it's both the most boring part of this, and it's also not high on additional conceptual content. Because all I'm doing is saying, okay, I might even say, if you actually trusted me, which you wouldn't have with my referee reports to be worried about. But and I said, okay, I take a structure that has, you know, a definite angle at each point, and I'm embedded in space-time with null lines right here, then I can derive a Regi calculus from that. All right, you might be willing to believe that. Okay, all I'm doing is actually demonstrating it. Let me just actually say how this plays out in the end. So. These terms right here, these are the potential terms. They represent the energy of interaction in the kind of center mass frame of these colliding qubits. These are the kinetic energy terms. We actually don't know what these are, right? We don't know what they are. Because to know what they are, we need to know what the structure of space-time is, right? Remember, you know, in Wheeler's summary, matter tells space-time how to curve, but then space-time has to tell matter where to go. Okay, so let me just finish stop this right now so we can talk about more or argue about more interesting things. So the steps are one. So step one, fix omega L. So we're going to fix the conformal factor at each point. So the trace of these Einstein-Regi equations hold. And if I write it out, actually write it out in terms of these angles, this ends up being, let me just make sure I got it right here. This just says that if I, at a particular point, if I sum all the hinges that belong to the neighborhood of that point, so remember the curvature stuff depends on neighboring points, okay? Then I take the derivative of the Regi calculus term, So the ordinary Reggie, this is what Reggie calculus is normally done without matter, okay? Because it's damn hard to include matter in Reggie calculus. So I had to include matter in Reggie calculus right here. Normally this would be zero in ordinary Reggie calculus without matter. But now I have this term from the trace of these other things, and so I get 1 over 16 pi h bar g theta sub lambda. So as it should happen with the quantum mechanical theory of the Planck length, h bar g shows up over here, Planck length squared shows up over here. This is a purely geometric term. And this is basically the scalar quantity. This is the scalar content of Einstein's equations. And the only scalar stuff for the matter is this theta. And this is the scalar stuff. This is the curvature. This is the Ricci scalar, the discretized Ricci scalar on that side. So that's the first part. So now this is matter. So we know this is, if you think of this, what is this? This is fixed by the computational history. It's a source term that corresponds to the matter. Here I have to pick omega so that this is whole. So what I have is basically a nonlinear partial difference equation in omega with a source that's given by these thetas. So this is matter, computational matter, tell space how to curve. Right? So that's step one. And this, by the way, this is actually very closely analogous. If you've just got a bunch of particles zooming around through space-time, so you know the causal structure, how do you pick the conformal factor? You don't know what it is, right? So you pick it so that Einstein's equations hold, actually, is how you do it. And let me just, before we ask your question, let's say, now what we knew, now we actually know the whole geometry of space-time. And so now we actually can assign our kinetic energy terms, and I'm just going to assign them. So basically, assign this kinetic energy stuff, the traceless part of this, so that the rest of these equations fall. And this is basically like saying, okay, these things move along null g d6 and t a b b is equal to 0. Right? Basically what I'm doing is I'm saying, okay, stuff moves along null g d6 and this equation, the ordinary, you know, pseudo-conservation equation holds. All right? And actually this is also kind of slavishly taken from the normal way. If you have the causal structure of space-time, then there's the stuff of Hawking analysis in other places of how you assign the rest of the metric given you know the causal structure. Yeah.
I still don't understand. Yeah, sure. You have a theta there, and then you have a state over there which gets the ball.
Yeah.
So here, theta is matter.
Theta is matter, right. So this is the internal, this is internal stuff, internal energy, energy times time. Right.
Over there, you would associate matter with state and not theta. So.
Right. I think what I did in making these computational histories was I decomposed the whole history of this computation into local energy eigenstates at each point, as a way of thinking about it. So that's what the decomposition did. So I decomposed it to places which have a local definite angle rotated.
Does this state have anything to do with that state?
So with the state?
Yeah.
So the theta for this U1 right here. So remember, this U1 has two terms. One in which they actually don't scatter, theta equals 0, and you size that vertex. The other, they scatter, theta is equal to some number. And it's the phase accumulated, theta is the phase accumulated by the non-zero energy eigenstate. Right, say what it is. It's actual energy times time, basically. Well, right, without the h-bar. H-bar theta is energy times time. Inside that
paper.
Yeah. Okay. So let me just wrap this up. So the point is that I'm killing off my audience entirely right here. So that's what happens when you give a tour card. But it was supposed to be like this, right? Like people. the original idea was to let people go at me as much as they wanted, and that's good. People probably haven't managed to do as much as they want, but they've done a lot, which is good. So each computational history now, sorry, each computational history, CB, so remember it has a definite fossil structure, definite angle of rotation at each point. I'll draw it again to remind you. Here's one of them. So here's the computational history. Each one corresponds to a Reggie calculus. So the Bayesian Einstein Reggie equations.
So each one corresponds to the solution?
Yeah, solution of the Einstein and Reggie equations, right.
Okay. So Reggie calculus is actually means a solution to you.
Right, so fine. Each one corresponds to Reggie calculus. Thanks. That makes it easier to write. So each one corresponds to Reggie calculus. Okay? And you know, I'm happy, you know, people want to do this another way, that's okay by me. I just did it in a way that worked out as closest to Reggie calculus. If you want to assign a space-time, there's another better way to do it. I'm happy with that. But the important thing is that and here's where the quantum mechanics come in, right? Is that the quantum mechanics only came in the quantum computation in a very simple way, okay? It wasn't complicated at all. It basically meant that a computation is a superposition of a whole bunch of different computational histories, and each of these computational histories corresponds to Reggie calculus. Okay? So you have essentially a space-time foam picture, if you want, of this quantum computation, where the fluctuations in what happens to information correspond to fluctuations in the metric. And then all I did here is I said, well, you know, how do we assign lengths to these metrics? We're just going to assign them so that it's a Reggie calculus. That's all I did. So let me just summarize. Then you can wail on me and all you want, because I truly accept it. So here, I need a drink of water or maybe something stronger after all this. I'm not claiming this is the right third quantum gravity or anything like that. All I'm saying that this is a theory of quantum gravity. Or this is, let's say, this is a quantum theory of gravity. Let's be careful about this. I never quantize any gravity here, right? I never vary any feature of the metric in any of this. The variation in causal structure came just from the variation of rooting of stuff in its quantum computation. Alright? I actually assigned the conformal factor at each point to say, okay, the trace of the Reggie equations hold. And this is actually something, this is kind of a philosophical issue. What does it mean to assign a length scale? Basically what I did is, so this is equal to 16 pi g, remember e times delta t for this gate. By assigning the conformal factor, I said, what is the energy at that gate? What is the time that it took? How long did it take to tick? Right, when I assign the length scale, that's what happens at these points. Okay? And in the case where you have atoms, rubidium atoms, or something, or cesium atoms in an atomic clock, well, you know what the energy is. But if you don't know what the energy is, then you have to make some assignment of it. Well, what does it mean to measure the energy otherwise? So I actually just took a convention for doing that. It provides, I'm afraid the gentleman who wanted to argue about this is now gone, so I'm not sure if this is good or bad. But it provides something that several things that I think are good, okay? So it provides a theory of, so the first thing it provides is a theory of the back reaction, okay? Essentially, by failing to quantize gravity and by deriving a metric from this quantum mechanical matter, then what I get is an immediate picture of what the back reaction is. You know, once I know what the quantum fluctuations are of this, you know, in the computation or the matter, I know what the quantum fluctuations of the metric are. It gives other stuff. So I have some preprints you can check it out on the archive. It tells you about black hole evaporation. So it allows you, as I mentioned, you know, once you make some onslaughts at the original, at the computation, it's like we're starting the way the universe starts out, and that's actually these onslaughts, you know, they all start out with a bunch of bits coming into existence and then being processed. If you coarse grain this, you get Gaussian fluctuations in the action in the action of these gates, because if you have fluctuations in these actions. Because actually the curvature is actually directly proportional to these actions. You get Gaussian fluctuations in the curvature. If you assume that the energies are positive, you find that what you get is a period of inflation, which corresponds with that inflates these fluctuations in the normal sort of fashion. No, I'm just summarizing one of the other results. I haven't shown this at all, okay? I haven't shown this to you right here, but I can show you why that's the case at some other point. It's also in my paper on this on the archive, okay? Why you get a period of inflation if the energy is positive. Well, it's basically you just have a homogeneous positive energy density, which gives you inflation. But because it's expanding, so the distance between the gates is getting bigger as time goes on, then actually the energy density is decreasing, so you get a kind of a roll down in the ordinary fashion. And so we're trying to look at those curvature fluctuations. So it gives you a mechanism, certainly, for looking at primordial curvature fluctuations. I'm not saying it's the right mechanism, but it's kind of, hey, at least you can calculate something, right? That's the point here. The point here is to be able to calculate stuff. And this allows you to calculate stuff. So in fact, I convinced that guy up there that it was so easy to calculate it because he thought it was content-free. But hey, what the heck. I'll show tomorrow that this actually implies a version of holography, kind of a different version, a sort of complementary version of holography. Once again, in the case of these energies are positive. I don't know, I'm agnostic. Maybe these states are all positive, zero or positive, as I wrote them down. Or maybe some could be negative. I don't know. The point is to compare it with experiment, compare it with observation, and see. All right. So it implies something about holography. I guess there's other stuff that it allows you to talk about as well. But it's a not really, I would call this a, this part I propagated is a theory, but this is not a full theory of everything or anything like that. It's a research program to look at theories of quantum gravity based on quantum computation under this "it from qubits" slogan. And right here, I bored everybody to tears by telling them in some greater detail than probably was necessary how you do some of this stuff. And I think there's still lots of questions about even like about individual pieces of this derivation. And my whole purpose on being here is to talk with people more about what needs to be done about this. So thank you very much for your patience. And now, if you have questions, let's go ahead and ask them. Yeah.
So if the original computation that you started with is a classical computation.
Yeah.
Which has a little bit of issues with universality. But ignoring that.
Yeah, yeah.
Suppose it's just controlled modulates.
Right.
Your next step still turns it into a quantum computation.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
So this is unable to describe purely classical systems.
Yeah, well, in some funny sense, that's right. That's a good point. Yeah, this is not a good way to describe classical gravity.
Can you explain that?
Well, okay, so if you have a non-trivial gate, U, right, then the next step is to say, well, what are its eigenvalues, right? And they're not all going to be the same because it does something non-trivial.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you consider the superposition of those two eigenspaces.
Yeah. This is very quantum mechanical. Yeah. So I'm happy with that. The world is quantum mechanical, so far as I know. Right. You could, you know, if you wanted, you could. So this, of course, gives you a way to do a discrete. This, by the way, even if it has nothing to do with quantum mechanics, this is a prescription. One thing people struggle with a lot is doing Regi calculus, this classical Regi calculus in the presence of matter, right? Because it's hard to say what to do in that case. This does give you a prescription for doing, you know, classical Regi calculus with some kind of math, but I wanted to say it's quantum mechanical, right? It just is quantum mechanical, and that's just the way it is. Not classical. Hold on.
Yes, so in our community there are a whole bunch of people who write down models which assign amplitudes to discretized version of space-time.
Exactly, yeah.
So, and they run into two problems, or
right.
At least two problems. One of them is that they end up having to sum over all in some sense, all discrete versions of
exactly stuff. Right, that's a problem.
That's one, and the second one is what we call the semi-classical limit problem.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I see that you by introducing this mother calculation,
yeah.
Everything from the start will be finite. It's 2 to the n, and you choose n large but finite.
Yeah, I was aware of this by the way when I did that. That was one of my reasons for doing this.
Right, exactly. So we just said okay, I don't want to.
I don't want to mess with that. Yeah. I've seen other people have troubles. Right.
I don't want to sum over all wiring diagrams or something like that.
I did that for a while, and I said this is bogus. I'm not going to do this.
Which probably doesn't exist like some anyway. Okay, so that's where you get it wrong, but.
Well, that exists as a sum. It's insane.
No, exactly.
But let's not do that.
It's always a finite. Okay, so I see that. So the second thing is less clear to me.
Yeah. How do we get it classical?
So you get all this sum which is 2 to the n terms.
Right.
They all have one, so some amplitude.
Yeah.
And some of them are very weird things, right?
Yeah, some of them are going to be totally weird. Some of them are going to look very non-classical, absolutely.
And so how do you convince me that I get the classical thing? Why do I get classical geometry?
So my feeling about, I'm not going to try to convince you that you necessarily get it. But the kind of prescription is that, okay, let's calculate and see what they look like, right? So because I give the prescription for calculating what these geometries look like, we can actually calculate and see what they look like,
right?
Okay.
So whatever you mean, how do you set up?
So let's say you have to
give yourself some mother calculation.
Yeah.
You have to do some input and some input state or something like that.
Right. So I just take this fiducial input state, right? And then you can look at different. So now of course you do need to look at what is your mother calculation going to be? Or you could imagine. I mean, I actually did do this. Like the set of all computations is a measurable set. Right, in the same way that the set of all discrete finite space times is a measurable set.
Right.
So you could try to sum over all that. But anyway, you can put a measure on it. And let's say we select some computation at random and see what it looks like. Well, if you select some computation at random, so there's two things that I've looked at, both of which give nice semi-classical kinds of things. The first one is no surprise at all. If I set up some cellular automaton-like thing, as some people suggest doing, it could put quantum cellular automaton. It's in 4 dimensions, 3+1 dimensions. It already looks pretty flat and classical. No surprise there. It looks like a
global time, right?
Yeah, it's a global time. Yeah. I don't think that. So that's not a solution of anything, right? That's just assuming what you want to put in. The other things that I've looked at are random wiring diagrams. So I take large random wiring diagrams. Those are very nicely computationally universal, right? If I decide which gates I can put in, because you can wire things so that they take pretty much any path that they want. In those cases, a random wiring diagram, the minimum average loop size goes to the logarithm of the number of points in the graph, which means, and this is a trick, by the way, from statistical mechanics, right? As the number of points gets big, these loops get large too, logarithmically. That means that you can embed this in large things where it's locally quite flat.
What was the finding? The minimum average loop size?
Yeah, the minimum average loop size in a random graph.
What does that mean?
Well, that means, so this is important in this case, right? Because if I want to embed this thing in a space-time, the kind of intrinsic curvature that I get, like from this embedding, it's going to be, I'm going to be constrained by constraints of, you know, how big these loops are. So this maybe is not obvious.
I'm trying to understand. I mean, you take all, I'm trying to get both the minimum and the average
I ask what's the smallest loop that gets me from point A to point B. And I'm allowed to choose at each point where I go.
Smallest loop that includes both points.
Yeah, so I want to look at the smallest path that takes me between 2 points on a random graph. That's logarithmic in the size of the graph.
So you generate a lot between of these two graphs.
Between 2 points and you average over pairs of points.
Yeah, so typical, if I take 2 typical points of a graph, a random graph, and ask how what's their minimum distance between them. Okay? But what this means is that actually you can embed these in a flat space-time to begin with. So you can choose to just embed them in a flat space-time. The curvatures are just, you just have a flat space-time with Gaussian curvature it inflates quite nicely. Everything stays nicely far apart. It doesn't collapse in a way. I know some of these, I mean, I guess one of the problems of the set of classical limit is many of these spacetimes, as you guys were telling me, just kind of collapse. So since then, since talking with you, realizing this was a problem, I went and calculated what happened. And they inflate, the points stay nicely far apart. And so you get something that looks like a nice flat, the inflation flattens everything out. So you get something that at least to begin with looks nice and flat and four-dimensional. And then, of course, you have this other question of like non-interference between these different paths. So that's this, luckily, Jim Hartle and Murray Gell-Mann and people have developed this decoherent histories approach, for example, and Jonathan Howell and others, exactly with Gaussian fluctuations, which if you coarse grain this, you get Gaussian fluctuations. So to show why if you've got these kinds of quantum mechanical systems, they tend to naturally decohere, or tend to decohere naturally. So I guess the answer to your question is that in the cases that I've looked at, which are the two cases I knew how to calculate, one of them kind of dumb, which the answer was already in there, the other not so obvious, because it's a big random graph, then the space-times look pretty normal. I mean, they have inflation, they've got locally Gaussian fluctuations, they get inflating, they look nicely four-dimensional. And I guess, so this would require a lot more calculation, that they also have decoherent histories. But I don't know that for a fact.
So I can see how you get matter telling space out to curve. Is also the opposite? Is space telling matter how to move?
Yeah. So that I just glossed over that because people started righteously raising their very perfectly rightful objections right as I got to that point. So in this assigning of a space-time, so when I assign I'm assigning the kinetic energy terms to say, you know, how much, what is